Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Fake the Nation, episode 206.
Here we go. Hello, hello, and welcome to Fake the Nation, where we talk about news, we talk about politics, and where we set up an overflow area for the millions of Fake the Nation fans in my head. I am your host, Nagin Farsad, and today we'll do a coronavirus check-in because we still have a pandemic. We'll also look at the 2020 horse race, and I wish we were looking at actual horses, but instead we're going to look at political candidates. And finally, efficiency. Is it a thing that happens in an office or not really? I am so excited by today's panel. We have with us a former Obama administration guy. He also has a podcast called In the Bubble. He's also been just a voice of reason and holding the administration to account on all things coronavirus. He's so fantastic. I'm so excited he was able to do the show today. You guys, it's Andy Slavitt. Hi, Andy.
Hi, Nagin. Do I sound like a voice of reason?
You really do. We also have joining us my buddy from the Wait, Don't Tell Me universe. You've heard us on panels together for that show. He's a comedian. I've seen him just absolutely kill in front of live audiences. So what you should do in your life is make sure you get to see him perform live. Ladies and gentlemen, it's Brian Babylon. Hey, Brian.
Hey, Nagin. How are you?
I'm good. All right, let us get into topic number one. I guess, where are we nationally and regionally with the coronavirus? What is going on? According to Dr. Fauci, there's a, quote, disturbing surge of the coronavirus in the United States. And in fact, the United States accounted for 20% of all new cases worldwide. Andy, let's start with you. I guess my big question for you is, what is happening and why is it happening?
You know, I think we're living somewhere near the cross section of denial, anger, and boredom. And that's a pretty dangerous place to be. We've now seen, as of this week, we're now back to the place where we have more cases every day than we had since March and April. Meanwhile, most of the rest of the world, when they get 5 or 10 cases, is just freaking out. I just talked to folks in Singapore yesterday, and they were very upset because they had like some number of cases, like 6, and we have 30,000. And I think
those are different numbers.
Those are different numbers. Very different numbers. And I think, you know, like the people in the South and the West, like a lot of the governors, were pretty confident when this was going through New York that this was a blue state pandemic. And when it came time to open up, they couldn't.
Well, I mean, to be fair to them, it is it's a partisan virus.
It's true.
The coronavirus announced itself as a Democrat.
Yeah, I mean, after Trump, I think it was a Reagan Democrat, and then Trump happened, and then sort of came back. And like, who else? I mean, who could blame the virus? It's kind of like, but they're now in this mode where they're like, wow, you mean this is happening to us too. And, you know, I'm spending a lot of time with people in Arizona, Texas, Florida. And, you know, again, the reason I say that this reaction is because in some states, they're just basically saying, we're not going to publish the numbers. And in some cases, they're saying, we're not going to do any testing. In other cases, they're starting to get a little bit worried because their hospitals are filling up.
Brian, tell us where you are and what kind of sense do you get about people's willingness to modify their behavior with respect to the pandemic?
I'm actually in Seattle, Washington, which is one of the first places to get hit hard with the virus. So I think for this area, since they went through it first, hard first, they kind of got their head together around it. But 3 months later, you know, it's a different thing. I think cabin fever finally took over. I was able to go down to that, the rest in peace, the CHOP zone, Chaz zone.
Chaz zone,
which turned into, like, I felt Burning Man for white people over Black Lives Matter. It was more of a Burning Man feel than a protest. But that's another story. So I think people are going to go outside regardless, and they use whatever excuse to do it. Like, even, I'm not saying the protests were not needed, but I think there still was a pandemic and people went out to protest, and they're still doing it 25, it's been, what, 25 days? So you can't stop people from getting out. So I think people have forgotten a little bit, because once it was over with in New York, not over with, but people, so, you know, once New York took their first blow and kept stepping, I think everyone else said, okay, it's pretty much over, in my opinion. And then, you know, in the other, you know, other places like, you know, the South, Florida, you know, Arizona, since those places.
Houston is looking like it's a new hotspot.
But those places aren't, you know, aren't really big media, you know, markets. So you really don't hear about places like that. So you don't, you forget, you know, the Tulsa, Oklahoma's like, there's a surge in Tulsa. Like, who cares about Tulsa? Who cares about Oklahoma? You know, that's in people's minds. I care, but a lot of people just don't care about those kind of places. So, you know, it's, and I think we're not so surprised this time. So I think, you know, sure, it will be a, it'll be a surge, but, like, you know, they say if you need a ventilator, you'll get a ventilator. That's what, you know, Don Trump said.
That's comforting.
Yeah. I also want to say, for the record that everybody keeps of everything I say, that I also care about Tulsa, Oklahoma.
I don't want Andy, people to think, yeah, we're on this air. Exclude Oklahoma. No, it's not that.
I'm undecided. I'm undecided about Tulsa.
But you understand what I'm saying? Like, you know, those smaller markets that don't have major football teams, that just might have a major minor league baseball team. They don't get the same energy. So,
Speaking of whether or not we care about Tulsa, Oklahoma, Andy, you wrote a Medium article the other day in which you said the coronavirus is proving, in which you said the coronavirus is a proving ground for American empathy. What did you mean by that?
Well, I mean, so first of all, now I sound a lack of empathy because I said I don't care about Tulsa, Oklahoma.
We all care about Tulsa, Oklahoma.
And for the record, I don't want to need a ventilator. So that's great that I can get one. But maybe it's a better path not to get one. You know, I wrote this thing on Twitter, and someone at Medium is kind enough to summarize my tweets. And I said, look, where we're doing well is science. Like, coming up with therapies, coming up with vaccines. Like, I have eminent confidence in our ability to do that. Where I'm not so confident is our ability to actually care enough about one another to do the right thing. And what I mean by that is it's becoming clearer and clearer that certain populations are much more susceptible to getting coronavirus and dying than others. And so, if you're older, if you're sicker, if you're a person of color, you have a higher propensity to get coronavirus and to die from it. There's lots of facts about that now. And back in March and April, everyone was staying inside because everybody was scared. But what happens now when people are like, oh, wait a minute, I'm young, white, well-off, some combination of those. I don't feel as at risk. The virus is still highly infectious. Are people going to essentially say, I care enough about my neighbors, even if I'm not at risk? And that requires a level of empathy and, I think, cohesion that, you know, I don't think we've been very good at. And I compare that to the rest of the world. You go all across the world, whether you're Asia, you're in Europe, you're in Oceania, wherever you are, the people have sort of said, I get it. You know, I may want to go to a bar. I may want to go to the church. I may want to go do this and that. But I'm going to potentially infect other people. And so they're stopping that kind of behavior.
Sure.
Well, I heard you, and I've been hearing this back and forth, and I sort of just now hate watch MSNBC just for fun.
you like to increase your blood pressure.
Yeah, it's just like, that's a whole nother topic. But it's sort of like when you said, I keep saying, the people of color thing that are our targets. And I understand what people are saying about that. And I would say this as the, black guy on this podcast. I get where people say people of color are dying, but it's a certain type of people of color. It's not attacking just people with dark skin, or it's attacking poor people. It's not attacking Kanye West or Dwayne Wade. They're okay. And I would say it's more of a social economic situation more than a targeted genetic thing. And it's affecting, we're seeing now, poor people in Tulsa, Oklahoma, poor people in Louisiana. And it's not necessarily, black people, but still the reason that black people are getting sick is a socioeconomic, systemic racism situation. So it's not, throw the baby out with the bathwater, but let's just focus on it's poor people and people who are in bad situations who can't get health care, or people who can't not work at that frontline food job or that frontline job where they have to be out there with people doing stuff.
Right, which then goes back to the fundamental issue, which is that, income inequality has bred this kind of health disparity. Mm-hmm. And income inequality is heaped disproportionately on people of color. And so that's why we're seeing the health disparity break down along racial lines the way that we have. That's an excellent point, Brian. And it's very, Bernie Sanders of you to continually emphasize the economic aspects of this.
It's true. I think another reason why we're in this is just the way I think our country is set up. And of course, I'm no fan of Donald Trump, but I think also, him at the helm of things makes things more horrible too, just to have a straight goof troop, at the top running the show. I think in other countries, they sort of have a unified plan versus this whole each state can take over this. There was never a unified plan. So when you let 50 different people have a say on a situation, things get real muddy.
Yeah. Talk about cohesion. And Andy, you kind of mentioned this too. There was a queer epidemiologist I think out of Harvard, and I'm blanking on their name and I apologize, who was saying that basically we need to have a conversation about the way we had a conversation about safe sex in the queer community versus unsafe sex as a way that we battle the AIDS epidemic. We need to be having that same conversation around safe coronavirus and unsafe coronavirus behavior. And because we're not getting any of those messages from the top, right, because Donnie is so totally fucking ill-equipped, and because his administration now just sends mixed signal upon mixed signal, there is no real, I think the fact that masks were not at that rally means we lack empathy for each other, and we don't have anyone from the top being like, hey guys, this is how you conduct, this is what empathy looks like, this mask is what empathy looks like. And so it becomes a really difficult situation. Andy, by the way, was the acting administrator of the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services under Obama, so you know a thing or two about healthcare on a mass scale. What do you wish we were, or like, what have you seen from other countries that you wish we were doing? Like, how do you think you would approach this if you had the reins of power?
We don't. That'd be dangerous. I would tell you that go start with a couple things that Brian said. One is we have to do a better job for sure talking to each other, which also means listening to each other. So we're used to looking at everything through a political prism. If Trump believes X, then I believe X. Or if Trump believes X, then I will definitely not believe X. you know, we're not going to get anywhere with a highly infectious disease as long as we put that filter on things. And I think we do that uniquely. And I think, you know, look, he tries to win by division. So I'd also hold him accountable. But the truth of the matter is, if you look around the world, you know, this ability to have a little bit of empathy and compassion and say, okay, I feel safe, therefore I'm going to go behave in ways that are not responsible. That's the thing that I don't have a lot of confidence in our ability, whether it's because you're, whether it's because of socioeconomic, whether it's because you don't have diabetes or heart condition or whatever it is. And you just sort of say, in the U.S. we're saying, hey, just isolate. If you're at risk, just don't go out. So first of all, I don't think that's practical. Second of all, I don't think that's very nice. I think it's very nice to say, hey, you know what? You live with your grandmother, therefore you shouldn't have to go. You shouldn't go out. Or, you know, you've had cancer. And therefore, you know, you just don't go out so the rest of us can enjoy ourselves. So some of it is just cultural mentality. And then there's a strategy. And Brian said this exactly right. You know, you go to New Zealand, their strategy is color-coded system. You go to the Czech Republic, their strategy is wear a mask. You go to Greece, their strategy is discipline. You go to Hong Kong, their strategy is hygiene. You go to Vietnam, it's testing. I mean, these are very diverse countries, not all of them well off. And they essentially just say, look, this is what we're all going to do. And it's not going to be fun. Some of us are going to go without income. We're going to try to support people the best we can. But it's going to be for a short period of time. Trump ate the marshmallow, if you know that adage about the marshmallow.
He
could have just bit the bullet for 4 weeks like everybody else did and all over the world, and he'd have had two marshmallows, and he didn't. And he just said, I'm eating a marshmallow. I'm not going to buy into this. The only thing motivating him now is the stock market. The only thing that will bring him back to talking about this again is the stock market.
I think that's an excellent point. And, you know, one thing I was was reading the World Economic Forum blog. It's not a big deal. I just read a lot. And they were talking about, it was actually very exciting because they were talking about this is something that requires multilateral action. And it's eminently possible, and we actually had all of the information. So imagine if we did have a world leader who believed in multilateral action, who knew how to play with others, right? Who knew how to wait for the marshmallow. We could have avoided this, which makes me really excited about November, which makes me really excited about having a new president, because this can be avoided in the future. Like, this is our big fat lesson. We're learning it, and we're learning how badly we need to go to the ballot box in November. But, you know, one thing they pointed out is this was, you know, people keep talking about it as a black swan event, but in fact, a lot of people had predicted it. People like Bill Gates literally said in a TED Talk in 2015, like, there will be a pandemic, and this is what it'll look like, and it'll look like the influenza and all that stuff. I almost said fluenza, like I was just shortening it by one syllable. Obviously the World Economic Forum is going to say that COVID-19 shouldn't be viewed as something that's discrediting globalization. Of course, they would say that. But again, globalization might mean that a vaccine, instead of it taking fucking decades the way it did for polio or whatever, it could be here by as early as, you know, January 2021, which is amazing, which is fantastic, which means communication across borders and the globalization that brought us that kind of communication can really help in these pandemic situations, especially when it comes to scientists talking to each other. The one, I think, embarrassing thing is that, and Brian, I don't know how you feel about this, but like, I'm embarrassed about, actually, Andy, I think you said in one of your articles, like, for the people I'm paraphrasing, instead of letting you just say it, I'm saying the people in other countries, please stop laughing at us. It's impolite.
Hurts our feelings.
My feelings are really hurt. My feelings are hurt because, and it's not like I need to be in the seat of empire, but I've grown used to being in the seat of empire. And the fact that our divisions with China, by the way, exacerbated this pandemic, that we couldn't work with them, and the fact that we couldn't work with the G20 in coming up with ways to have a multilateral solution because the guy at the top just won't do it, is so embarrassing. Brian, thoughts on the multilateral action that could, should, would have taken place?
Well, I mean, we can't coulda, shoulda, woulda now. You just have to understand that this is sort of part of the, sort of like the old thing. I don't know, have you ever taken castor oil, Nagin?
It makes you poop, I believe.
Barf.
Or okay, poop,
I don't know.
Yes.
It, whatever it is, something's coming out, okay? Whatever.
Something, yeah, right. There's an excretion.
Yeah, it's sort of like taking castor oil. You know, it's going to be bad, but when it's over, you'll see a whole new day. And I think, and I've sort of gotten to the point of...
You'll find the keys that you lost 2 weeks ago.
Yeah, you have to get to the point of, we clearly see there's a lot of things that were broken. And I will say this was probably the positive thing about having Donald Trump be president. It sort of ripped the scab off a lot of garbage that we've been putting Band-Aids over, like the police system, healthcare, the budget, our race problem. We can't hide it. Sort of like going over someone's house that has roaches and everyone's trying to pretend like they don't have roaches, but it's like, dog, I see that fucking roach, man. But it's sort of like now everyone sees the roaches. We see what the problem is. What we can do is come over and just try to gloss and put another Band-Aid over the situation. And I think once we get back into the global arena, because clearly we are out of the global arena. You know, they don't tell Donald Trump stuff. So we're not even in the global arena. We're just kind of doing our thing. When we come back, I think it'll be easier to come back more humble and we can start from scratch.
Yeah, guys, international community, we fucked up. This is also making me rethink who I am as a guest because I don't think I've ignored as many roaches as I should have in my past.
Oh, you busted people out?
I think I've just screamed, like knee-jerk reaction. You know what I mean? Like I couldn't control myself. Andy, final word on all of this. Any, what do you want us to walk away thinking about this week?
Look, people want to know who the bad guy is here. Like, that's how we're kind of wired for some reason.
Yeah.
You know, is it the Memorial Day barbecuers? Is it the protesters? Is it the president? Is it the governors? And I just fixate on one thing. The bad guy is actually the virus.
True.
But not really, Andy. The virus is not the bad guy. The virus is Mother Nature telling us to slow our butts down. And that virus is nature.
Well, I mean... I take your point, though, Andy, in that the real thing that's killing people is this virus.
Well, the point I'm trying to make, Brian. I mean, you make a very interesting metaphysical point that I'm hard to argue with. It's just that we're looking to point fingers at one another, and it's getting in our way of dealing with the situation. We're starting, I mean, every time I'm on cable TV, the first question is someone wants me to throw a high fast pitch at the governor or at the president or something like that.
Yeah.
And look, we are responsible for how we've reacted. And I completely agree with Brian that we have not reacted well. And there's a lot of lessons we can learn about one another here. However, this is, at some level, there's a lot of people doing the best they can. Sometimes they're getting it right. Sometimes they're doing it wrong. And you know, it's a tough situation. We had just a hair more, empathy, and we were better listeners, myself included. You know, we're going to do better. So yeah, this exposes a lot of things about us that aren't pretty. But our ability to sort of need to blame somebody, I don't think is helpful. But I do it anyway.
Well, I'm going to do a better job of listening by abruptly ending this segment and asking people to distract themselves into hearing about our sponsors. So let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we're going to talk about the horse race. Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie.
Also, discover more than 60 add-ons every week, like breakfast, on-the-go lunch, snacks, and beverages to help you stay fueled and feel good all day long. What are you waiting for? Folks, I feel like I've mentioned this before, but I tried other services that I was displeased with. And then a neighbor of mine was trying Factor. I had pulled them aside in the hallway and I was like, what are you feeling about this Factor? And they were like, it is delicious. You should definitely do it. So then me and my husband did it and we loved it. They are chef-prepared meals that arrive to your door, and then in 2 minutes, you could be eating them. Like, it's so simple, and they're actually delicious. And for people like me who just sometimes, my schedule can be so maniacal between traveling in different cities and, you know, doing stand-up gigs. It's like I just don't have a typical schedule where I can plan, set aside time for cooking and all that stuff. So something like Factor really helps for me. The other thing that I love to do is try not to eat carbs. So they have a keto option, which is fantastic. It's super delicious. They use premium ingredients. You can get stuff with like filet mignon and shrimp and truffle butter and broccolini and asparagus, right? Like real ingredients. They're no fuss, no mess meals. They eliminate the hassle of having to prep. They're tailored to your schedule. You can customize your weekly meals with flexibility. You can pause or reschedule. I've actually done that. I've both paused and rescheduled. Factor is basically your solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. We're celebrating Earth Day all month long, and look out for the Earth Month Eats badge on the menu for the lowest carbon footprint meals. So here's what I think you should do. I think you should head to factormeals.com/fakethenation50 and use the code fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first month plus 20% off your next month. That's code fakethenation50 at factormeals.com/fakethenation50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active. I am the type of person that has subscribed to things and I have forgotten about those things. I have paid twice for a children's educational app, and I didn't know that I was paying twice for several months. Until that is, I discovered Rocket Money, and because I use Rocket Money, it just showed up all these things. The thing that I was paying twice for that made me incredibly angry, thank God Rocket Money ended that for me. It also cancels the subscription for you, so you don't have to like go through the hassle of going to that site and figuring out how to cancel. They actually make canceling very difficult. I don't know if any of you have had the experience, but I have been on a roundabout 8-exit nightmare trying to unsubscribe to something before. Rocket Money eliminates that hassle. It also alerts you to an increase in subscription price. And this is something Rocket Money did for me. It negotiates a lower price for something you already subscribed to. So like for my cable bill, it got me a lower price. And I was very happy about that. Nearly 75% of people have subscriptions that they've forgotten about, which makes me feel better because I'm one of them. But it makes me feel terrible because what are we doing? Losing that money. I don't want to waste that money. And I know you don't want to waste that money. If you struggle with these kinds of purchases, if you struggle with finances in general, Rocket Money will help you with the budgeting, help you track your expenses, help you, like I said, cancel those unwanted subscriptions. It's a personal finance app that finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions. It monitors your spending. It helps you lower your bills so you can get back to saving. I mean, me and my husband have been on the warpath, and Rocket Money has been a really big part of that. It has over 5 million users with over $500 million in canceled subscriptions. The average member has saved up to $740 a year using the app's features, which is, I mean, that tracks for me. So stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions. Go to rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Again, that's rocketmoney.com/fakethenation. Save the money at rocketmoney.com/fakethenation.
This HeadGum Podcast is brought to you by Auraframes.
That is right.
From grandmothers to new mothers, aunts, even the friends of your life, every mom loves an Auraframe.
Holy shit, even aunts?
Yes, especially aunts.
Oh, well.
Because it was named the best digital photo frame by Wirecutter and selected as one of Oprah's favorite things. I mean, these Auraframes are guaranteed to bring joy to moms of all ages.
I believe it.
You have an Auraframe, don't you?
Yes, I actually more than believe it. I know it. I've got one for my mom, my mother-in-law, my grandmother-in-law.
And dare I say, your aunt?
And dare you say, my aunt and my aunt-in-law. Everyone's got one. Everyone loves them.
I mean, Mother's Day is right around the corner, and there's no better gift than a digital photo frame. You give them the frame. It's got preloaded pictures in there. And you know what? You can update it with an app. So every time you take a new picture of a sweet little person or place or thing in your life, it gets automatically sent to that frame.
Exactly.
And right now, Aura has a great deal for Mother's Day. Listeners can save on the perfect gift by visiting AuraFrames.com to get $30 off plus free shipping on their best-selling frame. Holy smokes.
Excellent deal.
Yeah, that's AuraFrames.com. You use the code HEADGUM at checkout to save.
HEADGUM. Nice.
Yes. HeadGum. It's easy to set up. It's loved by everybody, including Oprah, including your aunt. Mm-hmm. So do check them out. That's AuraFrames.com. Use code HeadGum at checkout to save.
Damn right.
And terms and conditions apply, of course.
Of course.
Thanks again to Aura.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective, unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Topic number two. The race in Kentucky between Amy McGrath and Charles Booker as the Democratic nominee to run against Mitch McConnell is too close to call. I was very interested to hear about this race. For those of you who don't know, Amy McGrath was favored to win. Charles Booker, though, has given her a run for her money, and he has been sort of actively protesting with Black Lives Matter. Amy McGrath has not. She just kind of went on the campaign trail and admitted that she had not joined any protest. This is an interesting race because it's saying a lot about Black Lives Matter, about centrism, about the what the party is grappling with internally. What do you guys make of this race, Brian?
Well, and this is the reason why MSNBC annoys me is because they, you know, if they're going to be the network of the left or whatever, they should give a little bit more airtime to that race. I'm not saying that candidate. And I'm not saying because the nation needs to fuel that race. I think that's one of the more important races of November is that Kentucky race, because if Mitch McConnell goes, so goes the Senate. And so, you know, kind of balances things out and takes steam out of the White House's swag. But no one's talking about that race. And it's kind of weird to me. You know, maybe they'll do it, you know, after the primaries. But I'm really interested in what happens there. I did not know that that lady did not march with anyone. And that's not a good look. Optically. Come on, honey. Optics. Yeah. Like.
Well, I mean, you know, and she... Well, that's the thing is that there's even, I think even among the best intentioned Democrats, there may be a bubble that they're living in, that they don't see stuff. Andy, what did you think of this race?
Well, you know, I think you're right. There's a bit of a microcosm here, which is like some people approaching this, and you use the word, you know, the establishment or pragmatic or whatever. Some people approach it face, say, I just want someone who's going to beat Mitch McConnell. And then there's other people that approach a race and say, hey, I want the person that's closest to my beliefs and my values. And I think that is a bit of a argument going on within the Democratic Party as a whole. Not saying that there aren't people who believe Amy McGrath isn't the best candidate. I think there are. But there are probably a lot of people who think she's the best candidate to beat Donald Trump. And that may be the principal reason why they like her. I mean, Donald Trump, I mean, Mitch McConnell in Kentucky, which is a state that is very conservative.
Well, can I answer your question,
I don't know
Andy?
The truth. Yeah.
But do you think, like, I'm curious, like, okay, the reason she didn't maybe march with Black Lives Matter, and I don't know why people, is like she didn't want to ruffle the feathers of some people who just, you know, your regular Kentucky person, who that may be. But I don't understand. Is she going for new voters or trying to play to old voters? Like, why wouldn't you do that?
I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I don't actually personally know her, and I haven't followed that race particularly closely.
I'm saying, in theory,
if that's the way she did it, if that's the reason, then she's. That's not a good look. I agree. I'd love to hear from her why. I mean, maybe she'd say something that was persuasive, but she should have to answer that question, because I don't think you can be asking to be in public office in 2020 and not being asked to go on the record on this issue. And I don't know what she has to say. Maybe she has something.
2010, maybe.
Yeah.
Right. 2010, definitely. Would have been fine. Would have been okay. She wouldn't have even been expected.
I mean, even last year, to be totally frank, it was okay to say, hey, I'm not a racist, so what do I have to do? You can't do that anymore. I mean, you can't do that anymore, and I think you won't be able to do that in the future. I think you have to be actively anti-racist. We're all, trying to learn all the ways that we were not doing that before. I'm talking about white people.
Even I'm surprised on the level of Juneteenth things that I've seen come out from companies, just every video game I play. It's amazing that how hard people have gone on this.
Right. Well, and that's what's fascinating about Amy McGrath, is that the bakery around the corner for me has taken a strong Black Lives Matter position, right? Never mind a Senate candidate. It's just like, come on. How are you not taking a stronger position, especially on something that on national polls, again, I don't know what the Kentucky polls are, but on national polls, people are very pro the protest and pro Black Lives Matter. Things have changed. Like, things just changed dramatically in 3 weeks. But I also think, you know, well, and just another interesting little turn of events here in New York, the primary race for Carolyn Maloney, she's our representative in my district. She's, you know, that race is not going to be called for weeks until they get all the absentee ballots counted. But just in the exit polling, she only has a slim lead over Suraj Patel, who had an insurgent candidacy against her. And again, Suraj Patel is no Charles Booker, but he's an outsider. He's a person of color. Like, you know, he's got some. He's a bit of an interesting candidate, and Carolyn Maloney has been around for decades, right? So we might be seeing more and more of what we saw in 2018, in 2020, and some of these primary results are an early indicator of that, of what could come for the Democratic Party. And again, I also think it's interesting to see a primary that's being held after the Black Lives Matter protest versus primaries that were held before the Black Lives Matter protest. We don't even know if Joe Biden would have won South Carolina if this had happened in January, right?
There's another potential conclusion out of this, in addition to what you said, which is that maybe, just maybe, more people are finally voting. And I haven't seen the data on that, but maybe people are getting off the sidelines who've historically sat in the sidelines. And so maybe the same number of people are voting for Carolyn Maloney or these other candidates, but the younger people have historically not voted as much. And maybe with all that's gone on, with our current leader, with what happened in my hometown with George Floyd, the murder there, maybe with all of these things, people are voting more. I hope that's part of what's happening.
Well, that's how most of elections are won. It's all about how you get the sideline people out. With Barack Obama, it was, you know, the sideline people were young white kids and black people. That's what was the sideline people. With Donald Trump, the sideline people were, oh, the Mountain Dew NASCAR crowd was the sideline people. So, you know, now the sideline people are the people who hate Donald Trump are going to be the sideline people that get activated. It's all about how you can activate those people on the fringes to come to your aid to vote for you.
Well, let's get into the Trump v. Biden race, because Biden's ahead of Trump in national polls. Well, Sleepy Joe. He's ahead by, Sleepy Joe is ahead by 14 points nationally. Of course, it's a whole different ballgame when we're talking about swing states, but he's also ahead in swing states, which is interesting.
He's ahead in Florida.
I mean, why is he ahead? Is it meaningful? What is this race looking like? Also, keep in mind, because we care so much about Tulsa, Oklahoma, let's mention it again. There was a rally on Saturday, as we all know, in Tulsa, and it was poorly attended, but it gave us a kind of, you know, first blush of what we might see from the Trump campaign. So let's just talk about what is the message of the Trump campaign, and then we'll talk about Biden. But what are the Republicans running on right now?
It's not the Republicans. It's what Donald Trump is running on.
True.
I mean, I will just say that. And he's straight hijacked the situation. I know I'm starting to come off like some type of weirdo Republican black guy on this podcast. But
are you Republican?
I'm a patriot. Andy, thank you very much.
So, Brian, what do you think Trump is running on?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, every rally speech is like watching a horrible open mic comic. Every speech is off the cuff, it's rambly, it's not true. Put together. It's like watching a garbage open mic comic.
And there's too much misogyny. Every open mic comic, when they start out their career, generally have a lot of misogynistic bits
for whatever reason. It's crazy. So I think right now, as he is tanking, he's going basically to the dark, dark place of just racism. You know, when he says us versus them, the way he speaks and phrases things, it's more of this good old-fashioned, below-average white person that coming for our stuff, vote for me so I can keep things normal. That's what he's running on.
And I also have to mention that not only did they start with that rally that was just like a disaster in terms of public health, but they also released an ad depicting Biden as aged and confused, confused, calling him, quote,
that is hilarious.
Calling him, quote, clearly diminished and lacking in, quote, mental fortitude. Donnie Junes posted memes portraying Biden as a pedophile, which they love the pedophile thing. I don't know where it came from, how, whatever, but they love it. And Donnie on the stage actually suggested that there's something wrong with Biden, which is again hilarious coming from him. Andy, what message are you gleaning from all of this?
Well, first of all, I think his campaign is clearly going to be no limits. I mean, you know, he loves the shock stuff. It got him there last time. I don't think it's going to get him there this time, but he will no limit. I mean, pedophile, we haven't seen anything yet. I mean. Secondly, I don't agree with Brian. 85 point spread of Republicans supporting Trump. If you call yourself a Republican these days, very likely you're a Trump supporter. If you're an elected Republican, unless you're Mitt Romney, you've been sitting on your ass, not saying anything, not criticizing, not doing anything. So I think the Republican Party owns this man 100%. Now, I'm not saying everybody who identifies as a Republican does, but I'm saying most of them do at this point. Third thing I'd say is we got to be very careful, because this 14-point shit is like the media loves a comeback story. So as soon as it's a 10-point lead or an 8-point lead, he's going to be mounting this, you know, come from behind thing. He's going to run. It's very clear the contours of the race to me are he's going to run as a divider. He's going to try to run the narrow path through the states he needs, appealing heavily to his people. Biden is going to attempt to run as a uniter, which, by the way, isn't all good either, but because it's not what everybody wants. But he's going to run as we got to heal the country. We got to get some of our historical credibility, moral centeredness, et cetera, back. And I'm going to be a transitional figure, and I'm going to appoint a vice president. And this is the most important decision he's going to make.
Yep.
He's going to appoint a vice president who people can say, this is our future. And this is the 2-for-1 package. I'm going to unify the country. And then this person's going to set the future direction.
Can I, now that you mentioned his most important decision that he's about to make, I think in a month from now, let's talk about the VP pick. You know, there's people like Kamala Harris and Elizabeth Warren, my personal favorite, Keisha Lance Bottoms, Val Demings, Susan Rice, Tammy Baldwin, Stacey Abrams. There's so many names being floated around. Andy, do you think any of these names or a couple of these names rise to the surface as a most natural choice?
I think they're all good. I mean, and by the way, the more names he surfaces, the harder he works at it, the more the better chance we have of coming up with more good names. Because I think there are people who've been qualified and never made the list before. I think he's going to make a decision. I hope he makes a decision that reveals something about himself and how he thinks. I have no idea which of those people he's going to pick. I've served on his Cancer Moonshot Task Force. I know him a little bit. I think he's going to make a decision that says, this is who I am. These are my values. This is who I'm made of. And you know, I don't know who that will be. But it may not be one of the, it may not be an Elizabeth Warren or a Kamala Harris. It may be a Val Demings, someone who's lesser known.
Brian, who do you want it to be?
Not Stacey Abrams, because that's a pander pick. Mm. Pick for the job, pick to win. And, you know, I would say pick to win Elizabeth Warren, but yeah. Optics, you know, optically, people just, too many white people. It's like, it's okay, you know, in my mind. And then I would say the long shot. My long shot would be Condi Rice.
Yeah, I don't think she's
Rice?
A long...
No, Condoleezza Rice.
Condoleezza Rice.
Literally Condoleezza Rice. Okay.
Yes. Yeah, I think there's a zero chance of that, but I do think
that's,
Susan Rice...
It doesn't feel like that's happening.
By the way, I just watched the movie W again. Did you see that, Brian?
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know, I hung out with Josh Brolin.
Ah, really?
At SNL. And I sat next to him. I was like, oh, shit. I was like, dude... Was it you, W, man? He's like, yeah.
He was great at that. But
he was great.
Do you remember the way Condoleezza Rice was portrayed in that movie?
I
don't remember who the actress was. But she would literally walk around with, like, nasaliest voice and just, like, repeat whatever George Bush said and nodded her head. They made her... It was the most unflattering...
Like a dum-dum.
Yeah, most unflattering portrayal of...
You know, did you see the portrayal of Condoleezza Rice by herself on 30 Rock?
No, I didn't. I did see her portrayal of herself in real life, though.
Ladies and gentlemen, if you have not seen 30 Rock, please watch all seasons.
Oh, my God. Thandi Newton was Condoleezza Rice.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
But in 30 Rock, she plays herself. She has some comedic timing. She has like an affair with Alec Baldwin. It's like a series arc. Like they come back to it a few times. Yeah. It's truly hilarious. But I think, you know, I think the optic, look, Elizabeth Warren is my personal pick because I think she's just the one who's the most qualified and who has the ideas that match what I want in life, you know? And I thought that about her presidential candidacy. I continue to think that. I do think that someone like Elizabeth Warren is not only too much of a celebrity, and I don't know, again, I don't know if it's uncouth or insensitive for me to say this, but yes, she's like a white woman. And it's weird because... Like
2020, like you said.
Yeah, it's the racial optics are really sensitive right now. But even still, a lot of movement leaders, and I'm talking about like from the Latinx community, from Black movement organizations, have supported Warren, you know? Yeah. They have said that she's good on the issues. Even Native Americans who were initially against her kind of some of them turn around and were like, you know what, she's actually really good. She came around. This is what she...
Can I ask you guys a question?
Yes.
Don't you think, and this is... I mean, I could say it because you're a comedian. Comedians can say the real hard things. Don't you really have to pick someone who can be president because Joe Biden is old. There has to be, let's just be real about that. You have to pick someone that someone can see, oh, you could be president if this guy hurts himself.
Oh, he knows. I think he knows that. I think that's
And I think everyone knows. I mean, I think everyone is there with you, Brian. Like this, that's why this VP pick has gotten so much attention, because he not only has to pick a woman, but he also has to pick a woman who's ready to lead on day one, because, and he's implied many times that he could be a one-term president, and that, you know, and that who knows about what could happen to someone of that age.
I think Brian's right. Everybody's going to picture, when they look at the VP, that person in the Oval Office. And, you know, that's going to be even more the point. I think you also need someone who can campaign too. I mean, because this is going to be a brutal slugfest. Well, he's great behind Zoom in the basement. That's his domain. But, you know, having someone out there, I don't know if you, who's getting a little bit of attention now late in the, I don't know if it's late in the game, but more recently is Karen Bass. I don't know if y'all know her. She is
Karen Baskin?
Bass, B-A-S-S.
Oh.
She's Congresswoman from California. She's African-American too. She's been rumored potentially to be speaker behind Pelosi someday. She's a little bit older than some of the other candidates. And very unknown.
What about the governor of Michigan?
I just had her on my podcast today, Gretchen Whitmer. She is I think she was more favored early on because of Michigan. I like her a lot. I don't think she's likely. In some part because maybe I think the conventional wisdom now is that he will pick someone black, but she's good.
Okay, well, this will just, you know, we'll keep our eyes open and, you know, and also I'm just ready to have a little bit of mild indifference to the VP pick in terms of like excitement. Like, you know, there's only a couple of names that are, I find truly exciting. I'm ready to look at their qualifications and be like, oh, okay, that person has executive experience, blah, blah, blah.
Can you say put aside Joe Biden, like if you go back a little bit, I'm older than both of you guys. You go to like, Kerry picked John Edwards. Gore picked Joe Lieberman. Mm. Those were two awful picks. I mean, we seriously cannot get it that wrong. And by the way, Sarah Palin on the other side too. Like, I mean,
historically,
Paul Ryan. I mean, people have picked some terrible candidates recently.
Wait a minute, who was Paul Ryan?
Mitt Romney.
Mitt Romney picked Paul Ryan.
People pay. You know, I'm a big Mitt Romney fan, and I always make comments on Mitt Romney's Instagram page, and all my friends see that sometimes.
Brian, I did not know this about you.
I get text messages like, dude, why are you commenting on Mitt Romney's Instagram page? Like, supportive things like, hey man, keep going. Like, his Instagram feed is very, very wholesome and sweet.
Also, why are your friends so focused on his Instagram feed that they noticed that you posted a comment, huh?
Because I guess I'm the only one that they know. I don't know how it comes up. It's like Brian Babylon commented on Mitt Romney's picture.
All right. Well, we're going to keep track of all this. Listeners of Fake the Nation, let me know, who do you think the VP pick is going to be? Who do you want it to be? I know a lot of you guys are with me on the picks. But I'm so curious. Like, let's think strategically. And let us now move on to topic number three. So companies have been out of the office for about 4 months now. Are they more productive during this pandemic? Should we be getting rid of offices? Does anyone miss the water cooler? That is the question before us. And I don't know, Brian, I think both you and I have less constant experience at an office. Is that true?
Well, you know, I used to work at WBEZ. in Chicago. So that was an office, but I had a cubicle. Actually, it was right next to Peter Sagal's office. I mean, desk. But I would never be at my desk. I would go home. I would do my show and go home.
When you needed to.
And I thought, you know, and I always hate people that fake work. It's so much time people spend at their desk pretending that they're working when the project that they're really working on really has nothing to do at that time, but you're sitting at your desk fake working.
Andy, you've managed a lot of people. Have you seen the phenomenon of fake working? And what do you think of like trying to run an organization as big as the one that you ran from home?
Oh, I used to fake work all the time. I mean, who hasn't? I mean, let's be honest here. Maybe. But look, like, it's funny. If you think about it, like, the last 10 years, if you've been inside an office, they've had this whole, like, let's break down the walls. Let's make it egalitarian. Let's get rid of the cube walls. Let's put everybody around a desk. You know, let's have couches where people can sit out. Like, literally, almost everything you would not want to do to if you were going to try to prevent the spread of a virus. Like, literally, like, we've got to make our office look like a living room. And that is, like, right? And now they're all like, uh-oh. Like, because you can't. Now you need to put up shields, and you need to have like all of these other things to be safe. Look, I think it's. I mean, look, my son just started his job on Monday in New York. First day of work, he moved to New York, started a job, and you know they literally sent him a desk chair. They don't have an office. They sent him a desk chair, and he's sitting in his tiny New York Brooklyn apartment, like working behind. And like so for him, I feel badly because like. He's 22 years old. He doesn't know anything or anybody. I mean, he thinks he knows everything, but it doesn't. And he's a very smart kid. And if he's listening to this, I love you. But like, you know, he needs like colleagues, and he needs to like someone to show him which end is up, and he needs to like get something wrong, and if someone goes over his shoulder, like for me, like shit. I'm working in shorts, and you know. And it's great, and I can be home, and people can be productive. And what I do, it's less of a deal. But I'm 53, he's 22. So I do think probably it depends. I mean, he's obviously going to be better at the tech stuff. But if he's going to, you know, build a career, grow as a person, learn how to work with people, you know, he's going to need more of that.
But, Andy, I mean, think about it. I think. This is just, and I was talking about this, this is just another evolution of just society and what we are versus, you know, people who had to, you know, a Zoom back in the day was a telegraph machine. You know, you had to, it was like beeps and things like that. And that was like the future. I think people are going to find a way to, I guess, connect through squares and you know, Zoom squares, and then there will be another way you connect with people if you ever see them out. Because you have to think about, you know, how much business, you know, I used to manage a team that was in Mumbai, India, and New Delhi, India. And this used to be conference calls. And when I went to India for the first time to meet my team, they didn't know that I was Black. They thought Brian was just this. You know, this was like MySpace time, so they couldn't just Google my face. Mm-hmm. This was, you know, right. So I got to New Delhi, and they were like, oh, my God, I never thought Brian was a Black guy this whole time on the phone. And it was just like, but now you see people's faces, you can communicate. I think it's going to be just another evolution of how we do things.
I think yes and no. Like, I agree with you in some part, but like I remember when like Blockbuster video came out, like, and people were like, okay, movie theaters are dead. Like, they're going to all be gone. No one's going to go to movie theater ever again. And, like, I it seemed logical, right? Because you could, like, go get this thing on a disc or a tape or whatever it was. And Netflix and all this stuff. Yet, people, there is something about the human that does crave togetherness and sociability. Not so much me, necessarily, at this point in my life. But, like, people are social creatures. Like, they like going to Starbucks and seeing each other, they like going to the office. You know, I think people you know, I think particularly see it my son's age. You know, he was just at college. And so, like, I think, yes, it can be done. But there is this urge that's going to need to be met, I think. Maybe I'm wrong, but that's going
to... But do you think you need that to sell widgets? Do you need to have... you know, people show up places. Do you think if I'm a business owner now, do I quickly make my business for the future of like, oh, you know what? Let's not spend that money on rent. Because I looked at Gap company. They owe almost $100 million in rent. You know, so much people like, you don't need to spend the money on rent. You could be a better business if you're trying to be more nimble moving for the future. I don't know. Maybe.
Well, I see what you're saying, Brian, but I think we read an article called "Are Companies More Productive in a Pandemic?" In the New York Times. And one of the things they talked about is like, where does all of this leave company culture? And I think that's a really big part of it. You know, we normally record this podcast at the Earwolf Studios in New York. And, you know, and so I don't work there every day, but I do go in once a week. You know, I say hi to Ashley. She's the office manager. She sets up a whole vibe in the office where everyone can like chat and be friendly and come up with ideas. I run into another host. We're like on the same schedule or something. This guy, Dan Pashman at The Sportful, he's been on the show. You should subscribe to his podcast. It's fantastic. And me and Dan always, he'll be like, oh, Nagin, I had an idea for Fake the Nation. He'll give me his idea. And we've literally run with some of his ideas on our show. And that's company culture to me. You know what I mean? Like, that's like, there's like little gummy bear jars and you sort of gather and you look at them like, I'm not going to eat that, but you really are. And as you're deciding to pretend to not eat it, someone walks in and you have a chat. And that to me is the thing that is that exchange of ideas that makes an office so valuable.
So can I just say, like, you probably work with good, smart, creative people that you like, you have stuff in common with, and that's cool. Like, these people might be your friends in real life. But, like, you know who cares about company culture? Companies. You know who doesn't care about company culture? People. I mean, facts. Facts.
Facts.
No, but disagree. Thinking about your son who's 22. So when I was 22 or 23, I started my first a kind of real job. I had a couple of like jobs, but my first super like real job was with KPMG. And so I was a consultant and it was really fun. You know what I mean? I met a bunch of people. It also became the foundation of my social network that I could meet people, that I could understand the politics of the office, that I could understand that the men were being paid more than me. All of that stuff happened because I was in an office, because there was that kind of exchange of ideas, because you build an intimacy with people that you really just fundamentally can't do online. And to me, that was one of the points that someone brought up in this article was, you know, people of color have a hard time, and women have a hard time speaking up at meetings. So they have a hard time in conference rooms, but it's a little bit easier to sort of notice them and get them to speak. On Zoom calls, it becomes that much more difficult. So where do they stand when it comes to promotions? Where do they stand when it comes to making themselves seen and heard so that they can rise through the ranks? That, I think, is something that requires more of that kind of face-to-face cultural interaction that happens in an office.
I don't know. I think it could work the other way. I mean, like all the FaceTime, the BS FaceTime that people put in with their boss, you know, going golfing, going out for drinks, when people who are, you know, other people don't get to do that. And it's a, you know, this sort of guy's culture. Maybe, I don't know, but it's possible that it just becomes a little more about the work.
About the work, yeah.
And like, hey, you did better work. So that shows more, because you can't come into my office and chat with me about the Chiefs game, you know?
Yeah, a lot of that fluff shit is done. And it's about those widgets. And if you get whoever sells those widgets, whoever gets it done, whoever gets the project done, whoever knows how to make things happen in this shitstorm, those are the people that are going to rise to the top.
All right, here's one more argument against both of you.
Yes.
I'm just reading from the article here. So a company called Chegg, an educational company, said that 86% of employees said their productivity was as good or as better than before, according to an internal survey. They attributed the uptick to not commuting and not having boundaries to the workday. So I was like, oh, wow, okay, so their productivity is better. A lot of these companies are wondering if that productivity uptick is even sustainable, that it's most likely to lead to a lot of burnout. The thing that stood out to me about these findings was, okay, so not commuting means you get to do more stuff. That makes sense. But not having boundaries to the workday sounds utterly and completely fucking miserable. You know what I mean? Like, that is the thing we're all living in right now, is not having boundaries to the workday. And that to me is, there is a thing, the reason why people go to Starbucks or where, you know, their local coffee seller that's independent and run by mom and pop, the reason why they go to those places is because they're trying to impose some sort of a boundary to their workday. And when you remove those boundaries, you're just working and you go into this, you know, endless day of work, and it does lead to burnout, and it does, you know, it requires almost too much discipline. It's like, why don't we just not have schools? Well, we need to have schools. Otherwise, kids can't discipline themselves, you know what I mean? And move from one subject to another.
But I think people were doing that anyway. People were working, the boundaries were broken anyway, even when people were commuting. People were still answering emails all time of night. People were still working on the weekend. Now you're just not. You're doing it at your house. You're now pulling a laptop up, laying in the bed, answering the email versus doing that and driving an hour and a half a day.
I'm finding myself agreeing with Brian and like hardening my position against, because it does work both ways. I mean, just say, so for example, you're as Brian said before, your work life could intrude on your personal life, and it still can. But now your personal life can intrude on your work life if you wanted to. So you can take an hour in the middle of the day and, you know, go have lunch with your partner or go for a walk or, you know, do something that, you know, allows you to manage your schedule and your life a little bit better. So you can, you know, yeah, you're right. It takes more discipline. And I guess it depends on your job. Like, do you identify, like I identify myself probably more with my, with what I do. And so it blends into my life a little bit more than maybe other people. And if you had a job that you hated and a boss that it would be willing to intrude on your life, it's undoubtedly harder. But I also think, you know, you can get some flexibility out of it too.
I do think that if we go back, that when we go back to the office, that there's going to be more, you know, flexible scenarios, especially when it comes to like parents and having to pick up kids and all that stuff. Like there's already been a move to make the office time more flexible to accommodate that stuff. And I think that's going to continue to happen. But I also think, you know, I also think it kind of goes down the middle, like who kind of likes spending time alone and who doesn't, you know what I mean? There's an extrovert introvert thing at play here. Friends of mine who are extroverts are like, this is fucking shitty. You know, I don't do well when I'm this alone. My last book I wrote partially in Bryant Park surrounded by hundreds of people every day. You know, that's kind of how I was able to get it done. I just don't get things done when I'm like alone in a room and it's quiet.
Not to get too personal, but if y'all have kids, like if you have, I don't, like our kids are older, but like people who have little kids are like, get me out of here. Like I love them.
That's me.
Right? Like I love them, but if I have to be around them 24 hours a day, one of us isn't going to make it. So it's like there is a benefit to being, you know, and like if you got to be home and then, you know, if you had a younger child, they're not going to turn it off. They see you, right? And they're going to be like, mom, dad, whatever it is.
Yeah.
So like getting out of the house, you know, has some benefits, I suppose, for that reason.
Well, I think that there were mixed opinions here on this segment. But listeners of Fake Nation, let me know what you think. But that, my friends, is the end of the show. Is there anything hopeful you want to close out with, Brian, for the people of Fake the Nation on for this week we're experiencing?
hopeful. We'll just, you know, just let's just watch this pandemic. I would say, you know, vote. Don't let things get to you. And like Andy said, have a little bit more empathy, because we need more of that coming together 9/11 energy than whatever we have now, because we don't have anything now, even with this. it's Mad Max energy right now. But yeah.
Empathy. Andy, do you have anything helpful to help us close the show?
You know, when we decided to start our podcast, it was my 18-year-old's idea. And he was like, "Dad, let's do something together." He could have said, "Dad, let's mow the yard together." And I would have said, "Yeah." I mean, he wanted to do this, so we did this. And so I just asked myself, like, what is it that we need right now? And so we try to do 50%, I call it 50% Winston Churchill, 50% Fred Rogers. Like, can we give people a unified message in a way that's helpful, that the whole family can listen to, and just kind of real honest conversation, like we just had, but, you know, this was funnier, as much as I hate to admit, because I tried to make ours funny, but it's not as good at it as you guys are. And, you know, I think that there are incredible moments that I think we're going to look back on in this period, and hopefully people will have stuff to be proud of. You know, and it's all going to be stuff you did for other people. Like, you're never going to look back and go, "I'm so proud of the fact that I accomplished something like this." You're going to be proud of the fact that someone was hurting worse than you were, and you took the time to recognize it, listen to them, do something about it, learn something. I mean, these are extraordinary moments that, you know, we're alive for, and we, you know, we have an opportunity to do something with them. And a lot of people are, and I have a lot of respect for people who are figuring that kind of thing out.
I love that. 50% Winston Churchill, 50% Fred Rogers. That's fantastic. Brian, Andy, I would really love for people of Fake the Nation to be able to follow you and all the stuff that you do. Brian, where do they find you online, and what do you want them to look at?
You can find me online on Twitter, Instagram, and all that at Brian Babylon, basic spelling. And I would like to promote, can I promote two things?
Please.
First, I would like to promote my buddy Hannibal Buress's new comedy special. He's releasing on YouTube July 3rd. He's being a disruptor to the system and putting it straight to the people. Miami Nights will be on YouTube July 3rd. And people can check out my two new musical albums on Spotify.
That's awesome. And Andy, where do people find you? What do you want them to look at?
So I'm at Ace Lavitt on Twitter. And I don't really pull a lot of punches on Twitter, as you said, so you follow me there. I have an Instagram account that's at Andy Slavitt, but I'm not as good at remembering to do that. And we did start this podcast called In the Bubble with Andy Slavitt, and I think I just talked about what it was. So if you want to listen to one of the episodes, and if you like it, that's fantastic. If you don't like it, then I really apologize.
If you don't like it, have empathy and say you liked it.
Exactly. Fake it.
Well, follow them on all of the things that they do and do not post on. Subscribe to Andy's podcast. And you guys know where to find me online. But also, just a reminder, you can see my short film, The Morning Papers, Morning as in Grief, at NagineFarsad.com/stream. And if you tip the filmmakers, the proceeds will go to the Workers' Justice Project and to the Actors Fund. And I also have a new column out in The Progressive. This one, as I do every issue, this one is called The Art of Being Non-Essential. It's about being one of the least essential workers. Us, comedians and, you know, magicians, we are just completely useless. And if you ever find yourself in a bunker with us, you should eat us, because that's what we're good for. So it's a column about that. And what I would really like to do is thank the people here that make Fake the Nation possible. That's our producer, Anita Flores, our talented audio engineer, Andy Christens, Gabi Alter wrote our theme music, Lily Fleshler helps with research, and we'd love to hear from you. So please send us your feedback, topics we should be chatting about, guest ideas. You can leave us a voicemail at 331-901-0005, or you can drop us a line at commentsatfakethenation.com. If you like what you hear, please leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, because it helps people find the show, and just tell your friends. That also helps people find the show. All right, you guys, that's it, and I'll be back in your earballs next week. Thank you.